The statistic that 50% of all marriages end in divorce has been floating around and believed to be true for years. But data show that divorce rates in the United States have actually been falling in the last 20 years. So, does this mean that the era of big divorce is over? And what's driving the drop in the divorce rate?
Stephanie Kuntz joins us now. She's the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families. She's also the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So by now, everyone's pretty familiar with the statistic that about 50% of marriages end in divorce. Where does that statistic stand today?
Well, it was always a very complicated statistic and one that really depended on a lot of factors. For one thing, marriage, your chance of divorce varies tremendously in terms of what age you marry, what your educational level is and stuff. But it's true that it seemed as though in the late 1970s, about half of all marriages on average were ending in divorce before they reached their 50th anniversary. Since then, though, you're right, the divorce rate has been falling. The number of divorces relative to the number of married people has fallen by about 25% since its peak in 79. Marriages are lasting longer. People who married in the early 1990s, 70% of them reached their 15th anniversary, up from only 65% of those who married in the 70s and 80s. And marriages that were formed in the 2000s, we don't have the 50-year mark yet, but they seem to be on track for divorcing even less frequently.
It's interesting. It's been a shift, sounds like, from the 70s and 80s, and yet the statistic has been pretty persistent over the last decade or two that 50% of marriages end in divorce. Why do you think it's been so hard to shake that conception?
Well, first of all, of course, bad news goes a lot further than good news most of the time. But secondly, it is true that the divorce rate is quite high, and I don't think we're turning that around. There's both good news and bad news hidden in this statistic about falling divorce rates. The good news is that a lot of the things that raised the risk of divorce in the 70s, no longer do so, largely because of the spread of more egalitarian ideas. One ironic thing is that women's rights, women's new expectations, their entry into the workforce initially destabilized marriage. Now it seems to stabilize it. It's no longer a risk when a wife takes a job or when a couple marries at an older age than average, like it used to be. It's no longer a divorce risk when a wife has more education than her husband than it used to be. So we're seeing that people are adjusting, and actually marriages are improving. Domestic violence rates have fallen immensely in the last 30 or 40 years.
So that's the good news. What's the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that this decline is almost entirely driven by more educated couples. Divorce rates have increased or stayed high for less educated couples. And because many such couples don't marry, marriage is becoming more selective, and that's another good news, bad news thing. People no longer feel compelled to marry or rush into marriage just to have sex or even to have a baby, which means there's a longer search period, more intentionality, but it also means that many couples who are nervous about marrying cohabit, and their breakup rates are higher than the divorce rates indicate. So you know, we have two things going on here that are very interesting. The good news for marriage is what most people back in the 60s and 70s were afraid was going to be bad news, the increasing equality of women. That turns out to be great for marriages. We know that of marriages formed since the early 1990s, not only are they less likely to divorce, the most egalitarian ones are the ones who report the highest level of marital satisfaction and, yes, sexual satisfaction as well. But, of course, we have another counter trend. Just as there's more equality between men and women, there's more inequality between the classes. And there's been a big increasing gap. In the 1950s, marriage rates were basically the same for all educational and income levels. And, in fact, high school-educated women were more likely to marry than college-educated women. They were the least likely. Now, college-educated women and high-earning women are actually more likely to marry in the past. They're the most likely to marry. They're the least likely to divorce. But as we get an increasing gap between the haves and have-nots, we're also seeing a gap between the I-dos and the I-do-nots and the ones who can make it last and the ones who can't.
So what kinds of things are destabilizing marriages or preventing marriages at all among people with a lower economic bracket?
Well, there's two things at work here. And one of them that most people emphasize is there have been cultural changes. It is no longer considered so terrible to have a child out of wedlock, or at least there are none of the legal stigma that there used to be. This could tempt some people into having a child unnecessarily, or at least without thinking about it well, but it also saves divorces in the long run, because shotgun marriages are very unstable and unhappy. But more so you get this new kind of freedom that women can support themselves, unlike the 1950s and 60s, that there's less legal stigma and social stigma for having a child out of wedlock. And that coincides with the fact that it's more important than ever to have a two-earner marriage. And first of all, now men want women who have earnings potential, just as women have always wanted men with earnings potential. But even from a woman's point of view, it's much more complicated than the past. Back in the 1940s and 50s, if you were a high school educated woman or less than high school, you could marry almost any man in your community. And because, first of all, you couldn't get a job that paid anything for yourself, so you kind of needed to marry that guy. But also, you could expect him to get steady wage rises. The high school educated men, the traditional working class, their real wages were rising 1 to 2% a year. The average man of that type doubled his real earnings between moving from age 25 to 35. Now we have a completely different situation. Job insecurity is increasing. Real earnings have been falling steadily for the past 30 years. And a woman has to say to herself, well, yes, a second earner would be great because I still earn less money than men, but I can support myself if I need to, and I have to weigh that against the fact that I might marry a guy who loses his job and is just another mouth to feed, or someone who reacts to the chronic economic stress of this insecurity by misusing our resources, by drug abuse or alcohol abuse or infidelity. And so marriage has higher rewards for educated couples. Dual earner egalitarian educated couples are the most materially well off, and they seem to be the most happy. But it also carries risks for less educated, more economically insecure people.
Well, to stick with economics for a moment, I believe that I read that people who are in higher socioeconomic brackets no longer married outside that bracket as much as they used to. So if you're someone in one of those upper brackets, you're more likely to marry there rather than mixing it up between the different socioeconomic classes.
Yes, that's a big change. You know, the old stereotype of the doctor who married the nurse, the executive who married the secretary. Well, now doctors marry other doctors. And that means that you've got a double whammy in terms of socioeconomic inequality. The professional, highly educated people who have the most earnings potential are the most likely for the women to continue working, so they've got two high incomes to compete with less educated couples who only have one earner, and outbid them for things like decent homes and stuff. So that certainly exacerbates inequality. On the other hand, it certainly increases gender equality. Women with higher earnings potential, whether they work or not, get more housework, more childcare from their husbands. They have more clout in their marriage.
Now, one area we haven't talked about, what about older adults and their divorce rate? Maybe people over 55, 60?
Well, that's another good news, bad news statistic. The good news is that people are living longer lives. They're less likely to end their marriages by widowing. You know, they've got a longer time to stay together. But the other side of it is they're less likely to put up with empty shell marriages. As people live longer, active lives, if you're healthy and active at age 65, you can expect to live another 20 years. And that makes staying together till death do us part sort of a challenge for marriages that may not be high conflict, but, you know, sort of there's not much left. Well, you know, I interviewed women who were married in the 1950s and 60s, and one of them told me that we had a saying that she said, you're fat at 40 and finished at 50. Well, nobody feels that way anymore. So if you reach 50 today and you're in an unsatisfying marriage, there's considerable incentive to leave it. Divorce rates for people over 50 have doubled since 1980 and tripled for people over age 65. And again, good news, bad news. The possibility, these are often amicable splits, the kids are growing, the opportunities for older people to repartner have never been greater. But the bad news is that there's less time to recoup financial losses or rebuild social networks. And the first tends to be a problem for women, and the second tends to be a problem for men.
Do those people who may be part of the gray divorce demographic, do they tend to remarry?
Not so much. We don't have most recent statistics about what's happening with remarrying marriages, and I'm hoping to be able to get some information as to whether remarriage rates are going up or down. Generally, though, they although they often do repartner, they're more likely to cohabit. In fact, elders are the fastest growing group of cohabitors in the country.
So now that marriage may not be the best barometer of families in the United States, what is?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that. And clearly we have, there's a tremendous increase in family diversity. There's no longer a typical average family. You know, it used to be in the 50s that you could pretty much guess that if you looked at a family, they would have two or three kids and a male breadwinner and a stay-at-home mom. Now you've got childless married couples, you've got cohabiting couples with kids, you've got same-sex couples, some of them legal and some of them not. You have dual-earner families, you've got single-parent families, you've got step-families. And increasingly, I think that we're being forced to say that a family is whoever you decide you've got to make those obligations to. And we're also finding, and this is the piece of good news in there, despite all the disruption and challenges by these very rapid changes, that the way a family functions is more important than its actual family structure. And so I think it's really important to redirect the conversation to help families function better, whatever their form.
We're talking right now with Stephanie Kuhn. She's the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families, and she's also the author of the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Talking about that old statistic that everybody's heard, that 50% of marriages end in divorce, it's still being trotted out today, but the thing is it's not true anymore, and divorce rates have been falling over the last 20 years. This is, our guest says, a good news, bad news story, and we'd love to know what you think about this. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're talking with Stephanie Kuntz. She's the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families. Chances are you've heard the statistic that 50% of marriages end in divorce. Well, it's not true anymore. Divorce rates have been falling for the last 20 years.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Why do you think marriages today are staying together longer? If you waited longer to get married yourself, like a lot of people do today, do you think it's helped you choose a better partner? Or do you think that instead maybe you'll choose never to get married? And what kind of partnership are you looking for in your would-be partner in a modern marriage? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go to our phones now. Anthony joins us first in Green Bay. Hey, Anthony.
Hello, ladies.
What do you think about the marriage question right now?
Well, I think that I'm 30 years old, and I waited because just because I was into a girl at some point in my 20s doesn't mean I always would be. And I had that foresight. And so people change as they get older. So why make a lifelong commitment when you're still developing?
Okay,
that's why I think people are waiting.
Gotcha. Thanks, Anthony. And Stephanie, what about that? Is there some sort of sense that people are choosier now and that maybe because of online dating, maybe other factors, people don't want to settle down right away, especially maybe like Anthony when they're in their 20s?
Oh, for sure. That's a very big factor. Now, it's interesting. It used to be in 1960, the average age of marriage for a woman was 20 years and 2 months before she could even drink champagne at her wedding. And the average age for men was 22. People who married much earlier or much later than that, had a much higher chance of divorce. Now, early marriage is still, and even more so, a risk for divorce. But one thing that has really changed, and it's very interesting, is that every year you postpone marriage, right up into your early 30s, you lower your chance of divorce. I think that's partly because of having time to know yourself better and to learn more what you want in a partner. It's also, I think, because a lot of that delay comes as people get higher education, which increases their economic stability and their emotional resources. They learn better negotiation skills. They learn more deferred gratification. These are all things that are important in modern marriages in a way they weren't in the 1950s, when the typical advice was to a woman was, just do whatever your husband wants you to do.
Well, Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate that. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. If you could put your finger on it, what would you say about why marriage rates are declining right now? Do you see this as a good news story or a bad news story? Our guess is there's a little of both. 800-642-1234. And we go now to Jack joining us in Baraboo. Hi, Jack.
Hi, did you say marriage rates are declining or divorce rates are declining?
Sorry, divorce rates. Good catch. Divorce rates.
But both are declining.
Well, my answer would be I think there's more information about how to do marriage well. And I think that's precipitating a reducing the divorce rates because people know how to do it better. I'm a baby boomer born in 1949. My parents' marriage was a train wreck. And by 1960, they were divorced. I pretty much grew up without any example of how to have a marriage. I have had one marriage and I'm divorced. And after about 40 years of studying how marriages work, I might marry again. And I would offer this to the guests. I would say that the best marriages, the ones where the two partners are happiest and the most fulfilled in the marriages, have happened for countless generations. It's only that in the past 50 or 80 years or so, that we studied and written about them.
Great. Well, thank you, Jack. Lots of good points there. And he's saying one of the points that Jack making is that there's more information now about how to have a successful marriage. And in the past, there may not have been any sort of education other than trial and error and hoping for the best. Do you think that's true, Stephanie?
Well, it may be partly true, but I think that more important is the fact that what we want out of marriage is changing. I mean, back in the 1950s and 60s, you know, I interviewed a lot of people who were married in those days. And, you know, the average length of courtship was only 6 months. And basically you were looking, you didn't have any alternatives. You would say, well, it was time to settle down. Or the woman would sometimes say, well, that's just what you did. That's all. I didn't want to become an old maid. And so you really married, in one sense, a gender stereotype rather than a real individual. And all the messages that there were about how to make marriage work involved very strict division of labor, that it was bad for the man. One sociologist wrote that a man who liked to change diapers might be legitimately suspected of having a little too much inner fat on his inner thigh. And a woman was told, you know, if she said she suspected her husband of infidelity, therapists would often say, well, are you keeping yourself well-groomed enough? Are you paying attention to his friends rather than your own? So there was whole different thing that was necessary to make marriages work. And nowadays we expect much more of marriage. And sometimes the expectations may be unrealistic, but on the whole, we try to live up to those expectations better than the past because we expect more equality and intimacy.
Now, you were saying that marriage rates themselves are also falling, divorce rates falling, but marriage too, so fewer people are getting married in general.
Well, yes. Now, marriage rates are complicated because if you count all the people over 18 who how many of them are married and how many of them are not, you're obviously, the marriage rate's going to fall as the age of marriage rises. So the question is, how many of these people will never marry? And I think most demographers now think that it could be somewhere between 15 and 20 to maybe even 25% of people who remain single. I'm not sure about that because the spread in the age of marriage is also increasing, and people are marrying for the first time at the age of 50 and even 60 at times. So it's hard to say. There's certainly more lifelong singlehood than in the past, but marriage is by no means dead. And as many of your callers have pointed out, the fact that people are taking longer to marry and being more selective, and not just marrying because they're running out, they go, what's the only way I can have sex and be respectable? These marriages are stronger. The couples know each other better. They know themselves better.
We'll go next to Sean. Sean is joining us in Spooner. Hi, Sean.
Hi. You know, I would love to get married someday, but as a child of divorce, I really, really, I really look for the advocacy of the children, because I wouldn't want my children to go through that.
So when you say you look for the advocacy of the children, are you saying that you want to make sure you're with a good partner so that divorce is not something the children have to go through?
Correct. I mean, I work with high school students every single day, and, you know, the majority that I work with are at risk, so I see it every single day. So, I mean, it's more something that I want to prevent my own children from having to go through.
I see. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing that, Sean. Do you think a lot of people take that into consideration, Stephanie, when they're choosing a life partner? Do they think about what could happen to the children they might have?
Well, I think that many people are afraid of divorce. I mean, that's one of the things that we see when we interview low-income couples and say, why are you not marrying? And they say, well, I'd almost rather be a single parent than go through the process of divorce because they've seen how hard it can be. And in fact, people really ought to look ahead to what happens if things go sour. I mean, when people ask me if they should have a prenuptial agreement, I often say, well, not just about money. You should agree what you'll do if you start to disagree and how you'll respond to the kids. And that's another little piece of good news, is that more couples are divorcing amicably. And we actually know that a couple that divorces that does not do the all the bad things that people used to do in the middle of divorces, and some people still do, that tell secrets, ask the children to take sides, engage in conflict, fight over the custody, have the child change schools halfway through the school year, which is actually a real risk factor, especially for adolescents. These kids can do fine, and in some cases they do better than if they were stuck in a high conflict or even a cold but contemptuous marriage. So there's no reason to assume the worst. You should think through the bad possibilities and then figure out how to move forward in your life, and you don't have to avoid marriage because of this fear.
Stephanie, your book is called Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Is love still the main reason that people are getting married, if not, you know, old-fashioned reasons like acquiring a piece of land or a herd of horses, which we assume does not happen anymore? Are people still just getting married for love, or are there more practical concerns that are bundled with it?
Well, there's always more practical concerns that are bundled with it. But the argument of my book is that for thousands of years, marriage was stable because it was a way of getting in-laws and getting advantageous in-laws, getting social respect, expanding your family labor force. For the upper classes, sometimes you even sealed peace treaties and military alliances with it. And when love became a legitimate, respectable reason, and young people began to be encouraged to choose their own mates rather than have parents do it, and to choose them on the basis of love, on the one hand, it became more possible to build loving relationships and to, you know, to look for happiness in your life, but it also became more possible to say, well, if the love dies, maybe we should leave. And divorce rates and love matches rose hand in hand throughout history. Now, I think most people do marry for love in a way that's much more profound than it was as late as the 1960s, when a poll of 2/3 of college women said they would consider marrying someone they didn't love if the man met all the other criteria, including being able to support them and this sort of thing. Nowadays, people are looking for love. I think the real challenge for us is to figure out what we mean by love. Our definitions of love were forged in the 19th century when there were these huge differences between men and women. Women looked for men who were taller, older, wiser, more educated, higher earning, a little scary because they knew things that you didn't know. And men looked for women who were compliant, you know, who looked up to them, who were all nurturing. And today, you know, love, that can lead to an initial attraction, but love has to be based on something much more profound than gender differences. It has to be much more individualized friendship. So I think people are marrying for love, and that we're engaged in a long, protracted process of figuring out what love means in a world where men and women are equal and do very similar things rather than being totally specialized.
We leave it there. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families. She's also the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage.